Die Podcast-Serie Klima-Check-In wird gefördert durch das Programm Nachhaltig Wirken, Förderung gemeinwohlorientierter Unternehmen durch das Bundesministerium für Wirtschaft und Energie und die Europäische Union über den Europäischen Sozialfonds Plus. Klimagerechtigkeit geht uns alle an. Viel Spaß beim Zuhören. The Podcast-Series Klima-Check-In ist funded by Nachhaltig Wirken, Funding for Public Benefit-Oriented Enterprises, by the German Federal Ministry for Economic Affairs and Energy and the European Union through the European Social Fund Plus. Climate justice affects all of us. Enjoy listening.
Right. Welcome, Philippe. Super glad you're here. Would you like to introduce yourself in your own words?
Yeah, happy to. Thanks for the invitation. I'm really happy to discuss and share a bit of the things that I've been doing for quite a long time now. So maybe that's a good way to start. My name is Felipe Schmidt Fonseca. I am Brazilian and I have been involved with projects that connect open source culture, open science, material sovereignty, so to say, and other fields for a quarter of a century now. And I have lived abroad from my perspective for 7 years. I lived in Europe, first in Scotland, and then I moved to Berlin. So altogether 7 years, and I am right now returning to Brazil after this cycle of 7 years abroad. During this period, I have concluded my PhD, it's a PhD in design at the University of Northumbria in a partnership with the Mozilla Foundation. That's what brought me to Berlin. And in this research, I have investigated practices of material care, of generosity in urban contexts, in specific practices of reuse of things, objects, and materials, and particularly, you know, collaborative, community-oriented reuse of materials.
Yeah, thank you. Before we dive a little bit deeper into these practices, I'm really curious, since you are constantly bridging those different geographies and also lifestyles and worlds, is there, in your opinion, a fundamental difference on how people approach repair or reuse in the given cultural context? What are your observations here?
I'd say that there are many variables. One of them would be culture, but even within people who share a similar culture, there are other variables, other differences that happen. I think what brought me to try to go deeper in this kind of topic was a project that we started here in Brazil in 2002, whose name was Meta Reciclagem. That is something like meta recycling. After some time, we understood that we were not recycling anything. We were just reusing things, but that's a conceptual conversation that only came later. But this project was focused on establishing community or open or grassroots oriented workshops in which we would receive secondhand, donated, discarded electronic equipment, basically, you know, usually computers, and we would make them usable again using free and open source software. That started, and sometimes I have to get myself to tell again that story, for especially when I'm talking to younger generations. We started that project before mobile phones had access to the internet. We started the project before wireless networks were widely available as they are today. So in the beginning, it was usually about setting up community spaces that would receive secondhand computers using free and open source software. And there was a very interesting practice by then of city administrations and state governments in Brazil of setting up open laboratories or open facilities in which people could access the internet, because computers were expensive, there were no Wi-Fi networks, as I said, but there were no 3G or 4G or 5G mobile networks. So in that context, here in Brazil, the use of computers was emerging, especially in the peripheries of big cities, as something that was more of a collective action. So people would go to a place in order to access the internet. And what we identified with MetaReciclagem was that many of the smaller places had problems with the maintenance of the computers. So that brought us, in a sense, a way to access equipment that were discarded by different kinds of organizations, but also of having the opportunity to help, to contribute with those organizations. So usually we would set up networks based on what was called by then thin client, thick server, in which we would have one computer that was a sort of a server, and the others were could work with not much of resources, with, you know, lower RAM and lower storage. And that made us question a lot the whole imaginary of technologies in which people expect to have, you know, the fastest computer, but we were making do with older computers, with secondhand, with computers with lower specs. And soon we understand that there was a potential connection to be made between what we were doing in terms of resource efficiency and what we understood as cultural practices here in Brazil that have to do with, you know, times of precarity in which you have to improvise solutions, in which you have to, you know, create your own way of living, even if you don't have access to the proper tools, to the proper equipment, if you don't have enough resources, if you don't have time, if you don't have knowledge and skills to do everything that you expect or that you're supposed to do. And we found a very interesting way to talk about these aspects in the idea of gambiarra. That is this term that we use here in Brazil. I wrote a bit about that over the years, but it's a term that describes all kind of improvised, informal, sometimes dangerous solutions that apply this notion of tactical creativity. So you need to perform a task and you don't have the proper tools or materials, and you still need to perform a task and you don't have time, so you will improvise. And gambiarra was usually understood, and I think it is still usually understood by higher classes in Brazil, as something that is undesirable, because there's this thing of detaching. If you're from a certain social class in Brazil, you detach yourself from gambiarra. Say, this is for poor people who cannot afford to do things properly. But to me, it's a very valuable skill in a world in which, you know, access to materials would probably become more and more scarce, in which the carbon footprint of industrial manufacturing has to be challenged, in which linear production is still, even though there's more discourse around circularity, but the majority of products are still manufactured following a linear perspective. So adding creativity and adding this capability of improvising with materials at the edges would be a way to not solve these problems, but at least mitigate the effects and mitigate the problem that sometimes at the edges in impoverished neighborhoods, people don't have cannot afford to have the same as people in higher class neighborhoods. So this practice of gambiarra became one of the the forces behind the expansion of Meta-Recyclaging as a network. So we started treating Gambiarra not as something that was accepted, but not kind of valued. And we started treating it as a sort of creative tactic that was present in many places in Brazilian cultures. And what we understood over time was that these kinds of practices are also present in other cultures that are marked by huge inequality and with lower access to resources. So you see similar terms being used in all of the Spanish-speaking Latin America, like requimbili, rebusque, cacharreo, and other terms in Spanish-speaking countries. There are similar terms in India when people talk about jugad, and there are similar, I think this similarity in a place where if you want to do something, it's not that easy to be able to afford just to buy the equipment, and you have to improvise. So in those places, I would say that there's more practices that connect to what we call in Brazil, Gambiarra.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. And it seems to me that Gambiarra is in a way the counter concept to consumerism or to the convenience culture we find ourselves in, particularly when it comes to tech. I think we both share this story of having worked in open source technologies for quite a while. And what I find striking is the way we have been lured into being happy with sitting at the receiving end of technology and simply consume technology without being able to, first of all, understand how it works or being in a position to repair it. And looking at, you know, specific hardware providers, it's even prohibitive to try to repair it because then, you know, you don't have a guarantee anymore. So that brings me to questioning also, I mean, first of all, our whole approach when it comes to technology, and particularly looking at today's world with big tech and all the threats that, you know, that come from that end. I really wonder, there's a very strong political dimension into Gambiarra and similar concepts where people try to regain, or maybe not even regain, but finally gaining a certain level of autonomy and sovereignty when it comes to tech. If we discuss those approaches here in Europe, or let's say in Germany, because you're also very familiar with the culture here, in Berlin, in Germany, you have been working here quite a bit. I really wonder what would be arguments for policymakers to sort of make them more aware of the needs to adapt a little bit these concepts in our culture here, or let's say in today's world at large.
I think there's a very interesting possibility, but it's always it's at the same time it's risky in a way. So there is this greenwashing aspect of the circularity discourse in which some, you know, major manufacturers start adding a bit of circularity that doesn't make much of a difference in the global scheme of things, but they claim to be doing more and more of that in order to not even comply, but at least to signal to a change in kind of industrial manufacturing practices. And I think it's highly questionable the amount of propaganda that is put into the whole circularity field in industrial policy. But at the same time, it allows arguments to be made at a local scale in which there is the possibility of negotiating with local authorities and claiming that practices that are based on local repairs, local reuse, upcycling, repurposing, recirculation of materials, claim that these things are in line with this major policy wave of adding more circularity to industrial production. So I think that there is this very interesting wave of legislation that comes with the European Waste Framework, then the Circular Economy Action Plan, then the Right to Repair Directive and the Eco-Design Directive. These things all signal in a good direction. I think the problem is that they are not fast enough to cope with the growing piles of discarded materials, materials that were extracted and energy was applied to them. So every time we discard, every time we incinerate landfill or incinerate landfill or what's the third one? Anyway, and anytime that we dismantle something that had potential value ahead of time, that means that we are wasting wasting potential uses of that. So everything that we can do in terms of making people identify the potential value of materials and extend the lifetime of whatever product, whatever object, I think we are going in the right direction. And in that context, the Circular Economy Action Plan, industrial policies, and the common sense understanding about circularity can be useful. But we must not be tricked and fooled, thinking that those large industrial players and that, national industrial policy developments will side with the ones that are trying to resist consumerism because they won't. But it's always a matter of, I guess, of navigating the possibilities of not subscribing to everything that these bodies are saying, but not just rejecting, because I think there are opportunities missed if we just say, no, I'm not engaging with that. And in that case, I guess international exchange in terms of practices of resource efficiency. I think that is a term that I found, during my research, and I think it's really a better way to put conversations that in other contexts may, can be called, degrowth, décroissance. And if you phrase it in a way that is not that would not be rejected initially by anybody related to policy that has to be to keep getting voted for office, there are ways to phrase things that would be very interesting. So resource efficiency and placing those people who are smart enough in different parts of the world of extracting or at least seizing all the potential value of materials and bringing that kind of knowledge to countries in Europe and to Germany, for instance. I think that there's a potential international exchange there that could be valuable, I guess, for both sides, because efficiency is a term that can be understood as I would say positive in many of these contexts.
Yeah, and I'm still baffled by the absence of knowledge providing in school curriculums when it comes to raw materials, life cycle analysis, or principles of eco-design, because that to me seems to be like a very separated body of knowledge that scholars dig into or engineers that work hand in hand with the industry. Or maybe also people, activists that really try to, raise a certain awareness or sensitivity when it comes to repair and reuse. But what I'm still so surprised in today's world, this particular knowledge is not evenly distributed, and it's not finding its way into public education systems. And I find this really questionable, because when you look in school agendas, of course, people talk about AI and all that, but then, the last argument to be made when it comes to a critical examination of AI tools is always, yeah, of course, data centers, they are very, power intense, and they use up a lot of energy, and it's entirely unclear where this energy is coming from. But the underlying question should rather be whether it's ethical to build infrastructures or whether, you know, whether anybody is in a position to build these infrastructures that endanger life in at such a scale. And I find it very interesting that no serious attempts have been made to put this into school agendas, or maybe even university agendas, really as something, as a basis. Yeah, what's your take on that?
Well, there's this international system that has been growing over the centuries that is all about alienating regular people from the way the products are made. And of course, there are many ways to expand on that conversation, but there is this sense that, you know, the public school system is not meant to provide solutions. It's meant to provide the stability of the current status quo. And if you think that the current system, the current, you know, international, global, neoliberal, proto-fascist capitalism has been brewing over the last centuries. And now maybe I need to sort of contradict myself, because in our, you know, 5 minutes ago, I just talked about efficiency. But efficiency is, you know, according to Ivan Illich, there is this problem with the idea of efficiency in a society that is based on the notion of productivity. And what Illich proposes is that we should be talking in terms of conviviality and organize the whole society in terms of how to engage more, to make people engage more with each other in convivial terms instead of focusing on productivity. And I guess efficiency owes a lot to that. But it's all built on, you know, upon a lie. I remember having trouble, it was, yeah, 10 years ago, when I had a presentation in a smaller place in Germany about Gambiarra and questioning the whole industrial era sort of practice of extracting things and transforming things and making that the basis of society. And there was this German professor at this business school, if I'm not mistaken, that he said, no, if you don't like the industrial age, maybe what do you put in its stead? Because that brought efficiency. And the whole myth of the industrial age being this European way of reframing manufacturing practices, it's based on this lie that, you know, resources will come, and resources were coming to Europe through colonial extraction, through slave trade and slave work, through the transformation of forests and natural settings into productive plantations. You know, I'm coming from Brazil, and my base, my work base and my heart here in Brazil is in the region of the Atlantic Forest. And the Atlantic Forest is the forest that people don't mention that much internationally. Everybody is aware about the Amazon. And of course, everybody needs to be aware of the Amazon, because there is a real risk that it will reach a tipping point in which it will desertify, and then that would change the climate in the whole world. But not many people in Europe talk about the Atlantic Forest. And the Atlantic Forest used to cover the 8,000-kilometer coast, you know, the Atlantic coast of Brazil, and it used to go more than 1,000 kilometers inland. And more than 90% of the Atlantic Forest was transformed into plantations, grazing land, cities, and industrial areas. That means less than 10% of the original rainforest is still standing. And here, exactly where I am, I'm living, I just moved back to Ubatuba, that is this smaller town by Brazilian standards, exactly where the Tropic of Capricorn intersects with the Atlantic coast of Brazil. In this city, we have more than 90% of preserved areas of the Atlantic rainforest. But what is fantastic is that even having, you know, in the whole coast of Brazil, even having less than 10% remaining of the Atlantic rainforest, that less than 10% still has more species of animals and plants than the whole of the European continent. So it's very lush, it's very fertile, it's very intense in terms of life. But all of that was replaced, and you know, there were many waves of development, as people usually used to teach in schools here in Brazil. The development waves, the first one was the sugarcane extraction, that meant bringing the practice of, you know, transforming forests into large, you know, immense sugarcane plantations. Then came the wave of gold extraction in Minas Gerais, then coffee plantations in the Paraíba River Valley, and all of that transformed all of that forest into you know, productive land, very productive and very unfertile. We call it the green deserts. And where those materials were, where all of the carbon that was extracted, or the fertile soil that was extracted and transformed into cheap resources, it ended up basically in Europe. All of that sugar, all of that gold, the tobacco, the coffee was brought to Europe to fuel the industrial revolution, so to say. Of course, I'm not talking only about Brazil. This is my perspective from Brazil. And then you can say, you can tell similar stories from places in Africa. And the saddest of all, the largest crime ever committed, you know, the centuries of slave trade that brought, you know, forced migration to work in the colonies here to produce cheap commodities to be sent to Europe and to fuel the Industrial Revolution. So all of this era, this last hundreds of years, in which people believe that, you know, the industrial era brought domain, mastery of humans over nature, it comes with this silence story. So questioning that, questioning the industrial practices, questioning consumerism, has to go with questioning the colonial era practices that are still ongoing. And of course, I'm not talking only about this dichotomy between Europe and the former colonies, because there are many actors here in Brazil who operate in a very similar way. So there is this internal aspect or domestic aspect of colonial practices that still extract materials without accounting for the longer term effects. And there are all the disasters that happen with the landslides connected to mining operations. So yeah, that's a I guess a bit of a diversion, but bringing that kind of reflection into the curriculum, I would say, would be not productive if we think of schools as a way to maintain society as it is. But having said that, I know that there are very interesting kind of pilot projects being developed. I know that Circular Berlin has developed a pilot project to bring discussions about circularity more to the public school curriculum. I see more and more design schools taking on at least a couple of, you know, circularity courses, and in some cases even more. I would say that there are now, you know, or there will be soon kind of full product design curriculums that are aware of circularity in all the phases. There is more, you know, industrial engineering or manufacturing engineering scholarship being developed that takes into account circularity, albeit on a kind of more limited aspect, not questioning productivity, not questioning the industrial era. But I think some things are moving in that direction. We have to influence schools, we have to influence universities, but we don't need to expect the solution to come from that. Or maybe there is no solution, we just need to face and embrace the contradictions and the challenges and keep trying to do things either way, even knowing that we will be defeated.
Yeah, I think that brings me to a lecture that I've looked up, a lecture of yours about irreparable futures. Right. And when I checked it out, the question came up to what extent you still consider the situation you just described as something that we can repair. And, you know, Because I understand from your work and activism that there must be a certain amount of hope and stubbornness to really to sort of try to change what is, because it can be quite overwhelming to look at things from the perspective of, our society, our, colonialism that we have never really learned to talk about over here, capitalism, and everything else that is so tightly interconnected can be overwhelming to look to really open up this big picture. But I got to know you as a person who is constantly working on strategies and who's constantly meeting with people and offering workshops and lectures and projects like the Reuse City, which clearly aim at changing the system for the better. So I'm really interested in your own notion of what is repairable and what isn't, and where to put the focus on here.
Yeah, I think one sort of wordplay that I added to the acknowledgement page on my thesis was that I'm hopeless but optimistic and sometimes hopeful and pessimistic. And I think this contradiction is something that I live by. To that, curiously, I'm today wearing this t-shirt that I just got from Ugo Valauri of the Restarted Project, that invited me to the Fix Fest in London last year. And the t-shirt says, "To repair is to rebel." But this, the, there is, I think things are coextensive. There is this connection between repairing an object and performing what Ernesto Rosa describes as an act of technological disobedience. So if a product was made to last for 2 years and you keep making it usable after that period, you are in a sense disobeying the design and manufacturing of that project. So this aspect of technological disobedience is one thing. But when you are repairing or upcycling or finding ways to reuse, to finding creative tactical ways to reuse things, it is also connected to the whole effort, at least to bring awareness of the historical the historical development that made a lot of people and greater parts of the earth suffer through this kind of colonial industrial extractive practices. I sometimes call that industrial populism, in which you are manufacturing things that, if you analyze it, you know that they are not sustainable, but because for-profit corporations have to return profits on, on their quarterly reports, you pretend that this problem doesn't exist. I once interviewed this engineer who worked for a landfill in Germany, and he said that the landfill would be full in, I don't know, 15 years, 20 years from the time that I was interviewing him. And there was no alternative in the region, so they would not be able to do anything after that landfill was completely filled. And I asked him, "And what happens then?" And he said, "I will probably be retired, living somewhere else, so it's not my problem anymore." And that's, I think, that's a portrait of what happens with industrial production, with all of these companies extracting more and more, copper, coltan, lithium, and other minerals to kind of fuel this pretense electrification that would be greening the economy, but it's not true because it's still heavily reliant on carbon and heavily damage, producing a lot of damage to the planet. So when you're insisting on that, that path, you're not taking care of all of the problems. And another thing that I once wrote was that whenever someone in Europe and then in other places of the world as well follow that, but in Europe, I started hearing about a new industrial era. And to me, it was like, so what, are you trying to create another industrial era when you didn't take care of the problems generated by the former ones? Because the problems are still here. The problems are causing trouble and climate change and inequality and, land extraction in the whole world. So when you try to create a new industrial era without acknowledging for the downsides of the previous ones, I think something is kind of pathologically wrong. But this connection between historical reparation, that is a term that is more and more used in discussions, I guess, more in North America and South America, but historical reparation and repair, when you bring the discussion up in Europe, it's not that clear. And I don't think people are really aware of the role of, this colonial, industrial, global capitalist practices in generating effects that should be subject to reparation, to historical reparation of people whose lives were extracted or moved from one place to the other without being asked and forced to work to fuel the industrial development in another part of the world. That should be connected to the ill effects of mass manufacturing of things that will be discarded because they are not made to last. These things are not at all disconnected.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's easier to understand the nexus when you talk about places in Africa, Southeast Asia, and Latin America. And in Europe, I think that discussion tends to focus too much on the object, on the, how do we extract most value from this object and perform something that is efficient for this thing without taking into account the whole social environmental systems around that?
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the issues that you can widely observe, at least here in Germany, is the fact that when it comes to environmental responsibility, people very often think that, responsibility that they have to take the personal responsibility for it, right? And that it becomes like a moral thing, whether you still take the plane or riding your car or whether or not you separate your rubbish and all that. But I think what's really missing here is exactly that kind of public conversation about all these elements that led to the situation we find ourselves in today. And because this conversation is not happening, and because also the media are not really covering, stories from that perspective, there's always this feeling of unease where people think, you know what, I'm tired of this whole sustainability debate because, there's only so much I can do. I want my state to do things. But since there is no deep talk, like real talk, on what led to that situation, of course, we end up again in silos and no one is willing to take responsibility. And I strongly believe if we would start having public discourses and conversation just with very frank and concrete words, like the words you are using, to describe situations such as colonialism or slavery or, genocide or whatever, we avoid those words. And by avoiding these words, we describe situations in a way that don't really move people, that are rather technical descriptions, right? And I really think it's so much of a cultural task to make people understand that in order to, to find a position here in this conversation, they need to understand the causal chain of events that actually led to that. And if we don't have this conversation, if we don't learn about it, if newspapers don't write about it, if politicians don't speak in such ways, there is no way to really get to a unified effort where everyone feels good in, stepping out a little bit of the consumerism role and trying to open up more to these practices. Because, when I talked to Cleo from Kreisler, the Berlin-based repair project, which is very successful right now, there is this dimension that we haven't touched on yet, where people engage in repair and they get to know other people and then they repair together. So in a way, they overcome their loneliness by doing this regular stuff together. And this is also something that I observe very often when we discuss the environment and the climate and everything. People sometimes feel very isolated from something they are actually an integral part of. So that is also something I very often observe. And this is also something Cleo told me, how difficult it is to overcome the loneliness and to make people feel part of a collective where it seems worthwhile for them to get engaged.
Yeah, and to me, that's one of the aspects that makes me very satisfied of being part of GIG, Global Innovation Gathering. There is this nonprofit and network based in Berlin, but whose majority of members, there are 250 members associated with GIG in the whole world. The majority in the Global South, or at least people who are working with projects in the Global South. And to me, it allows to de-silo the conversation. So whenever I'm developing a project, I'm working as a researcher at GIG since a couple of years. Whenever we are developing a project, even a project that was based in Germany, the one that we developed last year, the Circular Material Value Curriculum, we always try to bring this global conversation. So even if the project that we had a bit of funding to develop was about practices of assessing potentially reusable materials in Germany, we always make sure to add, at least some interviews or online conversations with people who are in different parts of the world, because that can be very inspiring. And I remember the first times that I read or watched videos, for instance, about the electronic landfills in Agbogbloshie, in Accra, in Ghana. That was one part of the story, but the other part of the story that was not shown in at least the first videos and stories that I read was that there's a lot of very innovative reuse of materials taking place there, and people are very, very skilled in making things be useful for a longer time. So these kinds of stories, these kinds of exchanges can be very inspiring. And indeed, if you are trying to face the big problem, it's very convenient for the people in power to isolate people and make every individual, every person feel guilty about their, their consuming habits. But there's not much that one person can do alone. It's like, sorting out their recyclables that won't get recycled in many cases, or traveling less by plane. And of course, all of these things have impact, and we should be mindful of our choices. But we won't solve the problem, and that problem was not created by us individuals who live in these different settings. It is a whole system that is optimized to produce more and more, extraction and inequality. So bringing more people to talk about and to do things together may bring a separate kind of a different kind of awareness of all that. I think it's highly problematic, and this is something that we're discussing here in Brazil with the Tropixo Network, the kind of festival that I founded some years ago, and now it became a sort of excuse to spend time with people, either in person or online. One of the things that we started discussing there, actually in a call a couple of days ago, was how to change the conversation about AI so that it's not only about interacting with a servant, because most of the AI, the the shape that AI takes in chatbots these days is about talking to servants. And to me, it would be very interesting to explore other kind of more conviviality-oriented ways of conversating, and maybe to use that as the blueprint to develop AI. For instance, I want to have AI that allows me to talk with with my ancestors, with spirits, with non-humans, with whole ecosystems. Why do I have to talk to a genie, a subservient, or a kind of something that acts as a servant but might be betraying me on my back? So I think these discussions are always interesting. And another aspect is this, the isolation, the hyper individualism that is exacerbated by these shapes of AI. One way to question that is through exactly what, how will we spend more time together? And there's this whole conversation about what is a community, because community is sometimes understood as a kind of geographic coincidence of people who live in the same neighborhood or region, and hence they should be called the community. But I tend to think more of community as a verb that is based on understanding and always remaking commonalities, multiple commonalities, but also differences, and understanding, how do you build community over time in which the commonalities are multiple, not only one, so you don't have to be homogeneous, and also that differences are a constitutive part of this community, so you can allow and maybe even enable and give save room for differences. So I think all of these things are together, and that's one of the ways I would say to address a trend that, to me, the way I try to understand that was that there is kind of my generation understanding the idea of climate anxiety, that there's this big problem happening and something has to be done. Then there is the generation of Greta Thunberg. I don't know how old she is right now, maybe 20 somethings, 25, I would say. That is the climate rebellion, which is very interesting to bring more of this discussion to the fore. But I would say that I have a daughter that is 15 and my son is 11. And what I see for now in their generation is something that I'm calling a climate fatigue. There's no point in discussion. There's no point in discussing climate action because nothing has happened, even though a lot of policy, a lot of international meetings were performed, a lot of science has been produced, but the people who get to make decisions keep making the decisions towards more oil, more carbon, more extraction, and less accountability for the industrial production. So I would say that there is this generation now that says, there's no point in discussion, in discussing. So if the previous generations were not able to solve it, all of the optimism, with all the techno-solutionism, why should we bother? And maybe reinforcing the need to be together as a way to kind of displace the conversation. So it's not, let's get together to solve the pollution in the beach here, because it's unsolvable where I am. But let's be together for the sake of being together, and while we are together, let's try to do something to mitigate, to adapt, to change. But yeah, we're not solving the problem, and maybe these problems are unsolvable for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, just coming back to what you said about AI and the way we talk about AI, I think artificial intelligence as a term is the perfect example of this, this very technocratic language that is, that completely fails to describe what it actually is. It's like artificial intelligence is so wrong on so many different levels. Because the underlying infrastructure is operated by human beings. We all know the work of content workers, data labelers, and the working conditions, exploitation of people from the global south who do this work. And then the term intelligence is also something that is, you know, this is something that is a very technological term. It doesn't point to communities or cultural practices. And when I was at the Platform Co-ops conference last year in Istanbul, we have discussed this notion of collective intelligence as something opposed to artificial intelligence. And this really starts with this awareness of, let's say, cultural heritage, or it can also be a certain body of knowledge that is shared among communities. And again, the starting point is overcoming isolation, you know, creating an awareness of, yes, I'm part of a larger collective. And whatever it is that we do here, all the knowledge that we have cultivated together is worthwhile to safeguard it and to, you know, to make sure that it doesn't get extracted by this global data economy. And I think strategies like that would open up the door for people to look at AI and other infrastructures at different ways and also get a sense of liberation. But again, in order to get to that point, a lot is needed in terms of communication and education, et cetera, et cetera. I just, for me, it was just striking when you mentioned, okay, we need to talk about AI in a different way, because I just find this term so misleading and obfuscating in so many different ways. And no one is objecting, right? We are using it. We are becoming part of this global storytelling, even though it's so wrong.
Yeah, but I think just as with circularity, AI, or even intelligence, I would never use the term intelligence in a serious conversation, because intelligence to me is also tilted towards this kind of mindset of problem solving. Intelligence is like, you know, let's accelerate problem solving and finding solutions. And I think problems and solutions are a weird framing for things that are beyond our reach. And that's something also that I find working with youth in a smaller town in Brazil. So, you know, things that we're not able to solve. Why are we trying to find this kind of dichotomy or this formulation of a problem and a solution? If the solution is beyond us, why should we try to find something like that? And but again, as much as with circularity, I think it's a matter of navigating the term and what people expect from it, and then trying to introduce a more nuanced conversation. So I would do the same with AI, but also collective intelligence, I can understand. And that there are terms, for instance, like social innovation, social environmental innovation. I'm not sure I like the term innovation, but sometimes it's a kind of boundary object that can be used to elicit a discussion with people who are not willing to hear me talking about, you know, 40 minutes about this or that specific term. But then we can use those terms as long as you don't, you know, we don't believe them fully as the answer. So, but yeah, I say that finding excuses to be together would be a way to go. And there's also this aspect that there's this interview that I keep talking about it, and on that lecture last year in London, I talked about it too, that this interview right when the far right president was elected in Brazil, this journalist, I don't know now if he was from Portugal or Spain, came to an indigenous leader in Brazil, an indigenous philosopher, very well-known author in Brazil, Ailton Krenak, and asked, so what will the indigenous people do now that there's a president that is you know, explicitly against your rights? And what Krenak said, that, you know, we will keep doing what we've been doing for the last 500 years. My concern is, what will the white man do about this new president? Because we know how to survive. And in many cases, it's not even just the broken world thinking, you know, Jackson and Donna Haraway, but it's this understanding that the world has ended. It's not that the world will end. The world has ended, but we keep telling the stories. And maybe we are just, you know, ancestors or deceased people talking about a world that doesn't exist anymore. But keeping in keeping that in, as we keep telling those stories, we kind of remain human along the way, even though the world has ended already. And this is, I guess, this way of threading this line between the ambiguity and the paradoxical living. And to me, that's something very important. Last month or 2 months ago, I was in Utrecht for the Impact Festival, and the theme this year was techno-ancestrality. And my question to many of the artists that were coming from South America there was that, or my ask to them is that they didn't have to submit to a worldview, the European worldview, that only believes that there is only one world, that we inhabit only one world. I think that we believe, indigenous cultures in Brazil believe that there are many worlds, that we are constantly traveling between them. People who not only believe that there is only one world, but also people who don't talk to their ancestors. And to me, that's a very important part of being a Brazilian, is that I have and engage in conversations with my ancestors and with deceased people and with the non-human. So these kinds of things should not limit us. And maybe that productivist way of one world, objective, efficient way of seeing the world should be kind of falling. And maybe we should bring other ways of understanding and discussing and being together.
I love that perspective. Thank you so much. And before we close this conversation, Felipe, I'm wondering, how can people connect with you and your work?
Well, the usual things are my design studio is called Reuse City, and the URL is reuse.city. My personal website is is.effe.me, and I can be found in many, you know, just, I guess you can Google Felipe Schmidt Fonseca, can be found there. And now I'm also experimenting a bit with the Tropixo network, but also on myself with federated social networks. I have my own presence on the FediWeb in different instances, and I'll be happy to exchange and talk more about these things. As you can see, I can talk for hours about many topics.
Yeah, and I love it. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Great. Thank you.